This is Theory of Change. I'm Matthew Sheffield.
Thanks for joining me for another episode. This one is a very special one because I'm excited to announce that here at Flux, we are adding another podcast to our network. It is the Elect Tourette podcast, hosted by Jennifer Taylor Skinner. And I wanted to bring her here on Theory of Change today to have a more topical-based discussion and also to talk about her program as well. So I'm really excited about that. And the topic that we're going to be discussing today is the recent announcement by Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell that he is going to be stepping down as the leader of the Republicans in the Senate. He is the longest-serving member of any party to have led his party. And there's a lot to talk about with his legacy. And I think it's pretty clear at this point that Mitch McConnell paved the way for Donald Trump in many, many different ways. And we'll get into that. And so I am pleased to welcome Jennifer Taylor Skinner. Welcome to Theory of Change, Jennifer.
Thank you, Matthew. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it's exciting. And I'm glad to have you as a member of the Flux Network. And so before we get into the topic of the show, though, can you tell my audience and the Flux audience just a little bit about your show and how long you've been doing it and what you do there?
Sure. The Electorate. It's a play on the word electorate, of course, electorate. I started the podcast, I think, in mid or late 2017. A lot of things were happening in 2017. We know what the biggest thing was. Of course, it was Trump's inauguration, the election after the 2016 election. For me, I was really frustrated at all the misogyny in the media and in the political discourse directed at Hillary Clinton. And we don't need to revisit that. That was a huge problem. I mean, that was a huge problem and one of the primary reasons why I believe that she lost. And what I wanted to do with the electorate was to get people used to hearing women in leadership roles, hearing women express their expertise in the context of politics, because I think that's part of the problem. If you look at some of the statistics, like very few of the experts back then, at least, who were talking about politics on television were women, right? And so that, I wanted to kind of change that with the electorate. And so what I do is on the electorate, I interview only women or people, anyone who isn't a man, about things that are really important in politics right now. Anything that's important to social justice or any cultural issues. And we kind of have these in-depth conversations about what's happening. And that's what the electorate is. And it's been really helpful for me. It's just been kind of cathartic for me after that kind of post-2016 PTSD or trauma we all have. But yes, yeah, so I've been doing it for a while now. It feels like it hasn't been that long, but it's been a while. So that's what the electorate is.
Yeah, and it's also important. I do want to say from my standpoint that I feel like that the podcasting space, especially the political podcasting space, doesn't have enough women in it as well. And that's a serious problem, especially in terms of that a lot of men, regardless of what their race, they don't have as much at stake when it comes to these far right policies that are being shoved on everybody now with increasing frequency. Like a lot of them, it's not as real to a lot of men. And that's why I personally try to have as many women on my shows and work with women, because it is an imbalance that needs to be corrected, I think.
Yeah. And I just want to clarify that isn't a lot of people, when they think about podcasts like The Electorate, they think it's a show about women's issues. And it's not, because all issues are women's issues, yeah. Right? It's about all issues. We can talk about the economy. We talk about climate change. The thing is that the conversations that you're getting are through the lens of women, right? So climate change will affect everyone of all genders, all races. It'll affect some people more than others. But the solutions will look different through the lens of someone who will be more affected, through the lens of someone who's marginalized, through the lens of a woman. So that's what I wanted to do. So it isn't just about women's issues. I mean, if you want to categorize abortion as a woman's issue, sure, that's fine. Abortion isn't just a woman's issue. I just want to make sure that's clear. So it isn't just issues like that. It's anything that you can think of, but through the lens of women. So men, listen to the electorate too, or if you're not a man, anyone, everyone's welcome.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Well, and yeah, I'm excited for people to be able to do that in somewhat greater numbers. So I'm glad to have you on board. All right. So the news topic that we're going to go through today, I think, is that it's one that is pretty significant, which is that Mitch McConnell, who is now the longest serving Senate majority leader in history, announced this week as we're recording that he was going to be resigning in November and that he would serve out his term in office, but he would step down as the leader of the Senate Republicans. And it's a little weird because I feel like to some degree it didn't get as much coverage as I thought it would. Did you feel that way at all? I mean, obviously we have this hellish news cycle.
Right. We have a hellish news cycle. I mean, I feel like, so granted, it only just happened, right? And like you said, we have a hellish news cycle. I think there was a bombing or a bomb scare, I think, in Alabama that happened on the same day or around the same time. So there's a lot of things to cover. And honestly, that maybe there was probably more coverage of it online between politicos going on about why they're so happy that Mitch McConnell is stepping down. I think that maybe some of the joy on the left, on our side, was maybe a little kind of premature or misplaced, because Mitch McConnell, when he does step down as majority leader, he's going to be replaced by someone who is younger and who's probably more extreme. I'll just say that.
Yeah, well, and definitely somebody who will be even more beholden to Donald Trump, because right. He's going to work very hard to try to put his stamp on that Senate leadership election. Trump, of course, was very instrumental in getting Mike Johnson to be the Speaker of the House, because before, originally, the guy who was going to take over from Kevin McCarthy was going to be Tom Emmert, who Trump explicitly said he did not want him to be the Speaker. And magically, the party that claims to hate cancel culture, magically, they canceled this guy and he did not have a chance out. And so it'll be interesting to see who he tries to put his finger on the scale for. But that's probably going to be a thing that's going to be a months long kind of summertime discussion, perhaps. Whoever can kiss his ring the hardest, I guess.
The only exciting thing that I see, the thing worth celebrating in relation to Mr. McConnell stepping down, is that regardless of who replaces him, he was pretty effective in bringing forth this kind of right-wing Christian nationalist vision across the country, right, on a national level, just in relation to his judicial appointments and reshaping the Supreme Court. And so why I think that him stepping down is a good thing for our side is that I can't imagine anyone replacing him who will be that effective. Right? I mean, you're on their side, he was really, really good at what he did. Just thinking of the Supreme Court judicial appointments, the way that he finagled getting Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court and denying President Obama a chance to appoint a Supreme Court justice with Merrick Garland, you know, and then flipping the script when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. And then within weeks, having hearings for Amy Coney Barrett. Like that was kind of, if not, I hate to use the word evil, but you know, it was kind of masterful. And I can't imagine, I can't envision anyone on the Republican side being as effective as he's been, right? So if anything, that possibly could be a good thing for Democrats. We'll get someone, it's kind of a circus right now, thinking of who's left, who's remaining.
Yeah, and that is actually a good point, because when you look at the House side of things, they're just in complete and total chaos. And they all hate each other, and they're all constantly going after each other and tearing at each other's throats. And as a result, they really can't pass on anything like this, because under the Johnson speakership, this has been the most unproductive Congress in terms of bills passed in a very, very long time. I think, depending on the metric, at least in the past 100 years. And I'd heard somebody claim it was since the Civil War, but I didn't look up the stat on that. But yeah, no, and I think that's a great point. And it's also funny, though, because the right wing hates Mitch McConnell. And it was funny because when I was on in the right wing media space, I liked Mitch McConnell because I did see him as effective and skilled at legislative strategy and tactics. And I would tell that to my fellow Republicans who hated him, and they did not want to hear it.
Right. Right. Well, look what we have now, right? I mean, lots of people did see Roe v. Wade being overturned, but you can chalk that up to Mitch McConnell, right? It's on his plate. Oh, yeah. He did that, right? Affirmative action. All of those really huge decisions that have gone through the Supreme Court are due to his remake of the Supreme Court. By not only did he make over 200 judicial appointments broadly, but there were three justices on the Supreme Court under Trump, due to Mitch McConnell and his leadership, I guess.
Yeah.
And speaking of the House side, we were mentioning the House, Hakeem Jeffries had Nancy Pelosi as his mentor, presumably, right? They work very closely together. And he's been very effective. He will be very effective if Democrats regain the majority there. Whoever takes over for Mitch McConnell, because Mitch McConnell is... his health status is kind of questionable. We don't really know what's happening with him. They're not being very transparent with that. We're not really sure if there will be that kind of back and forth mentorship, right? Will he be able to mentor someone to be the kind of leader that he has been in the Senate? I very much doubt it. So that's another good thing for Democrats, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, and on the judiciary side of things, besides reshaping it in pretty much a wholesale fashion because of how long he was the leader, what he did with that is really important, because I think he understood before almost any other Republican that the public isn't going to vote for their explicit agenda. So the public isn't going to vote for privatizing social security. They're not going to vote to criminalize abortion. They're not going to vote to get rid of same-sex marriage. They're not going to vote to eliminate the Department of Education, get rid of the Affordable Health Care Act. They don't want any of these things that Republicans have been obsessed with for decades.
Right.
Those ideas are unpopular, but McConnell figured out that if he could rig the judicial system in favor of Republicans, they could still get those outputs through the courts in a way that would also not jeopardize their electoral futures. I mean, it is incredible what he figured out in that regard, because basically that strategy has allowed, because the Republican Party is very different compared to right-wing parties outside of the United States in the industrialized world.
Right.
They're much, much more radical. They're much further to the right. And that happened because of Mitch McConnell, even though he wasn't directly aligned with the Freedom Caucus types, he protected them through the filibuster and through his takeover.
Right, 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 exactly. And although you can't get the majority of the public to vote for those specific legislative aims, right, you can get them to vote for Donald Trump. For some reason, there's a disconnect there, and presumably it's because Donald Trump doesn't really talk about legislation at all, right? I mean, he kind of skirts around it. He basically just talks about his grievances when he does rallies. He's only recently started to talk about abortion, saying that he's up for like a 16-week abortion ban. I think he's reduced it to 15 weeks. But the people who are steadfast Trump voters are not really, I don't think they're really listening to that, right? They're just voting for their man, Donald Trump. So. Yeah, it was a really good marriage there, Trump and McConnell together, to kind of remake the country in their image. Yeah. It's not really good, great for everyone else, but actually it's not really good for anyone. It's not good for anyone. Even the people who are voting for Trump, it's actually terrible for them. And hopefully someday they will wake up and see it. I doubt it. But yeah.
Yeah. And it is, and that combination, it's been really important, because I think the other thing about McConnell is that because he is, he's very intelligent. He is well-dressed. He's well-spoken. He's articulate. I mean, he's not particularly exciting, but, his stature within the Republican Party gave permission to a lot of people who are sort of white-collar, upper middle-class people to be like, well, see, this is still the same Republican Party that it was
always. That Trump didn't, he didn't take care, he didn't become a dictator. We constrained him. We hemmed him in. And he really gave them permission to think that. And so, like, it'll be interesting with him gone if that affects anybody's permission structure. I don't know.
Huh, that's interesting, because I think Mike Johnson also gives that same appearance, right? They give this appearance of kind of these non-emotional, rational, intellectual Republicans. But if you step back and you look at their positions, they're essentially the same as Donald Trump, right? Mike Johnson is a very extreme. I know we're talking about the House again. He's a very extreme. I mean, we don't need to go into him. But yeah, I could see how Mitch McConnell has that image of being kind of a non-reactionary. Compare him to someone like, I don't know, who's on the Senate now that is the
opposite. Josh Hawley would be an example.
Josh Hawley. Yeah, that's a great example. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and he has a better, and it's, who knows what the guy believes, because he never really talks about it in terms of religion.
Right.
But at the very least, he knows not to wear it on his sleeve the way that a Josh Hall, some of these other people very much are interested in doing. And that's important because, and I'm speaking from my own personal experience here, that when I was on the right wing, that as a secular conservative person, I really wanted to believe that people like me were equal partners in the party or even slightly above. I desperately did not want to think that I was, you know, in some sort of junior arrangement with religious fanatics. Because, I mean, the reality is the people who have these extreme viewpoints about whether it's suppressing women or going after non-Christians or anti-LGBTQ stuff or racist stuff, like, fortunately, they are still a pretty small minority. They are a minority in the United States, but they have a lot of power within the Republican Party. And Mitch McConnell gave them that power. He knew who they were. He knew what they wanted. And he decided, well, I want to be the Senate Majority Leader, so I'm going to go along with it. And that was, yeah.
Yeah, right. And you're right. He is kind of a closed book. It's hard to know what he's thinking. I think the most emotive I've ever seen him was during the Obama administration, during Obama's term. He said, my goal is to make Obama a one-term president. That's probably the most emotion I've ever seen from the man. He was like bordering on anger, I guess, perhaps. But yeah, he's a closed book, that one.
Yeah, and I think he said that he believed his most significant accomplishment was keeping Merrick Garland off the Supreme Court, which that's probably accurate to say, and certainly unfortunate as well. So, but I mean, the other thing about McConnell that I think is worth thinking about and talking about is in the context of him as sort of the last survivor of the Ronald Reagan Republicanism.
So when I think about those years, one of the things that I do remember about Mitch McConnell is that, and that's really relevant in the battle that's happening right now with aid for Ukraine, is he used to be a staunch supporter of NATO. And that used to be an issue that you could count on either side of the aisle, right? Republicans and Democrats. During those years, he was a staunch supporter of NATO. And now that's all off the table. And that's specifically due to whatever Trump has going with Putin.
Yeah, and it's also that McConnell was, and his line of thought, it was more of the robust militaristic foreign policy tradition, whereas Trump clearly identifies more with the libertarian isolationist kind of thing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really sure Trump thinks about foreign policy that deeply. I mean, that's another conversation. I mean, I think that he's just taking direction from some unknown, invisible source. I really don't think that he thinks about foreign policy that. Yeah, I don't think he has a philosophy. Right? I don't think even libertarianism.
Yeah.
The isolation, if he is an isolationist, and he arguably is, it's not an idea that came from his own head. It's disadvantage democracy to disadvantage us in some way. Mm. I mean, I think what I'm getting at, and again, that's a whole other conversation, but.
We could talk about the specific people if you want, but to be honest, like those articles, and I've seen a couple of people do those articles.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's necessarily going to be the only candidates that are going to be along, because like RFK Jr. for some reason endorsed Rand Paul to be the Senate majority.
Yeah.
So what do you think? Do you think it's worth talking about these other people or not really?
Not really. I mean, because honestly, I've seen the names that have been floating around mainstream media of the people who might replace McConnell, but I have a feeling that it's going to be a wild card. It's someone that we haven't thought of, kind of like Mike Johnson, right? And whoever that person is going to be, they're going to be younger and they're going to be very extreme. The only thing that I think that we might have going for us is the fact that they won't have that strategic mind that Mitch McConnell has, and they'll be less effective in the end, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. I think that's what will happen. And probably we'll have more chaos in the Senate Republican caucus, which it's certainly bad for America, but it is good that they can't get their act together.
In some ways, yes. We do need two functioning parties.
Yeah. Although we don't need a strong Republican Party. Thank you, Nancy.
No. We don't. We don't need a strong Republican Party.
Yeah. I guess before we move on from McConnell, though, I did want to touch on that in some of the valedictory coverage or review of McConnell coverage that you're going to see, this idea that he was some sort of opponent to Donald Trump. And I think that that's only barely true. So to the extent that they opposed each other, it was a matter of particular strategy for specific events. Right. It wasn't their overall agenda. They agreed on most things overall because they're in the same party. And I mean, ultimately, when Mitch McConnell had that chance to go after, to get rid of Trump, he could have gotten rid of him during that second impeachment because the House explicitly impeached Trump before he had left office and left several days for that trial to happen while he was president. And Mitch McConnell deliberately refused to try Donald Trump during that time window. And then after Trump had left office, explicitly said, well, we can't vote to convict him because he's not the president anymore. And then not acknowledging at any point in time that, oh, and I made it so that was the case. I mean, just really, really dishonest. And like, ultimately, he never opposed Trump in any meaningful way. And I really hope that the mainstream media doesn't lie or get that wrong.
Right. I mean, the thing is, if there's one consistent thing about Mitch McConnell, or one reliable thing, is the fact that he is interested in furthering conservative power, no matter how that happens. And I think that he realized at some point that supporting him by just being quiet or like letting him get away with things was helpful in him furthering conservative power for the long term, right? He probably didn't like Donald Trump's style. He's probably a bit of a snob in that sense. But he realized that neither of them have scruples. That's the one thing they have in common. And they kind of made an atypical pairing that kind of worked well for furthering this extreme right-wing agenda on a national level. They kind of worked well together, even if they're nothing alike, even if they don't like each other personally. And so I think Mitch McConnell at some point realized that Trump was useful in helping him further that agenda, maybe faster than he realized that he could do it on his own.
Yeah. And it's one of the things I often say is that it's important for people to distinguish that most of what calls itself conservative in America is actually reactionary. It is not conservative, because a conservative is somebody who wants to keep things how they are, whereas a reactionary wants to roll back modernity and attack the foundations that everyone accepts as our current way of life. Like, a conservative would be in favor of keeping Roe versus Wade rather than wanting to overturn it. And McConnell, I think it really illustrates kind of that the partnership between conservatism and reactionism, that they are allies ultimately, and that a conservative, generally speaking, is not going to oppose reactionism. And I guess the other person, though, that kind of is at that intersection is Nikki Haley, though. And if McConnell was sort of the last empowered conservative in Republican politics. She's kind of like the, I don't know, like the dying breath of that Reagan conservatism, if you will.
It's really hard to pin Nikki Haley down, right? I can't really get a good sense of who she wants to be politically and who she wants to be seen as broadly. In some senses, and in some ways, she wants to parrot the most extreme right-wing talking points, right? When she was given a chance to clarify the Republican or the conservative position on what was the cause of the Civil War, which was clearly slavery, she said something like it was just freedoms or something random, right? She didn't give the right answer. She knows what the right answer is. She knows what the right answer is, but she performed the most extreme right-wing answer that she knew was floating around at the time. And the same thing with IVF. If you'd asked Nikki Haley about IVF 5 years ago or 3 years ago, she would not say what she did the other day in her interview with I think it was on MSNBC. She said, "I think of embryos as babies." Actually, let me get her exact quote. She said, "You can cut this out." She said in her interview, I think it was on MSNBC. She goes, "Embryos are babies to me. To me, embryos are babies." Newsflash: that's the wrong answer. That's the wrong answer, but it's the extreme answer, right? And she's in this really interesting position where, you know, people who are at the far extreme of conservatism right now usually fall in line under Trump. They fall on their Trump voters, their MAGA. But she is also taking these extreme positions, but she's also one of the only Republicans who is openly and publicly speaking out against Trump, right? So I'm not really sure who she's hoping to capture, who her audience is, and what she's planning to do. I mean, one theory I have is that she's hoping something will happen. She's hoping something will happen to Trump. And that's my longstanding theory, that she's hoping that one of these cases will come through in her favor and she'll be elected, because she's not winning any of the primaries. But I don't know. She's not in touch with who the conservative base is right now. I think it's clear to them that she is just parroting these points and she may or may not actually believe them. So anyway, that's my first take on Nikki Haley.
Yeah. Well, and when you look at the exit poll results, I mean, yeah, to your point that she's getting anywhere close to the majority of self-identified Republican voters in the primaries, and she's getting independents and Democrats. That's who is voting for her. But she also doesn't want to speak to them or like actually court, like figure out, well, why are these people voting for me? What do they want? How can I give them what they want? Instead, she keeps grasping in vain for the MAGA coalition, which despises her. And that's been, and she's been doing this. And all the Republican candidates who ran against Trump, except for Chris Christie, they all followed this same strategy. They refused to tell the truth about him. And then as a result, the voters kind of, well, they didn't choose them. Like it's hilarious that Republican consultants always love to say, well, you need to draw distinctions between the parties and the candidates. That's what will make voters go to you if you do that. But they never did that with Donald Trump. They never, and they were all afraid. They were all afraid of him, that he would attack them, even though, of course, he still attacked them anyway. Like that's the even more absurd situation about it, is that they thought somehow that if they didn't attack him directly or in a tough fashion, that it would somehow redound to their benefit. And it never did. And this didn't work in 2016 either. It's just, it was amazing to me, the incompetence and timidity from Republicans with him.
Another interesting thing about Nikki Haley's place right now in the Republican Party and also running against Trump in this primary is that Donald Trump never has to say her name. He laid the groundwork for how his base feels about people like Nikki Haley long before she ran against him. He laid the groundwork for how conservatives and Republicans feel about people like Nikki Haley way back in 2015, arguably. And he was making all of those misogynistic points about Hillary Clinton. He was telling his base how to feel about women as leaders, right? And that's the context within where Nikki Haley is stepping into. The Republican Party and conservatives do not like women. Arguably, they've never really liked women. And they like women even less thanks to Donald Trump, right? So he doesn't have to utter her name. They don't like brown people. Nikki Haley, of course, is Indian American. They don't like brown people. They don't like women. And also, he's been making comments about the way women look. If they aren't young and blonde, like his daughter, you know, that's also a strike against them. So he's laid the groundwork. He doesn't have to say her name at all. And I think that that's one of the challenges among many that she has.
Yeah, no, good point. And she herself also is kind of illustrative of this quandary that right-wing women are all in. Because like when I was on the right wing, that all the women that I knew who worked in Republican politics, all of them with the exception of two, they knew hundreds of women, all of them except for two were very religious, all of them. Because like, if you're not super religious, there just isn't really any incentive to be in the Republican Party if you're a woman, because the party is, as you said, it is actively hostile to you. It is trying to take control of your body. Late last month, there was a controversy on the right wing about a video that was posted on TikTok of some women dancing. And these reactionary Christians and their incel allies, they were enraged about this, that this was, it looked like some sorority had put together a group event to go to a Mardi Gras party. And so they were dancing to this local rapper who wrote a song about a guy that just goes around and films Louisianans having a good time and that guy is a fun personality because what he does is he really does show like there is something that is special and unique about the culture of Louisiana, especially in regards to the South. Like it is a really integrated place where people of all races are hanging out and having a good time and acknowledging and sharing in each other's humanity, not just, you know, sharing a drink or a cigarette, but, you know, like actually being there with each other and right. hanging out with each other. Like that right. is my favorite thing, absolutely, about New Orleans and that whole culture, which of course is why the right wing was so angry about it, because you can't have a bunch of white women dancing to a rap song. Right. That's not allowed.
right. Wow, that's a whole other show. We could go on about that. Yeah, I agree with you about New Orleans. I love New Orleans. It is a place where there is a lot of cultural intermingling. Thing about that video and the sorority girls, or the sorority women, rather, it's white women dancing to this rap song. Yeah. When I first heard about that story, I mean, the first thing that came to mind is that their anger towards Taylor Swift. I don't know if you made that connection, but yeah, they have an expectation.
That. Yeah, that's right.
They have an expectation of white women, right? Especially white women who look a certain way, that they adhere to certain cultural values, right? And so publicly they were saying, oh, Taylor Swift were mad at her because she might endorse Biden, right? That never really made sense to me. What they're angry about is that I think, this is just my theory, that they are, what's the word? I had a great word in my head. That they suspect that, or they are upset that she is messing with the NFL, but her boyfriend, Travis Kelce, he is kind of very similar to that culture that you might see in New Orleans, and that he's kind of has one foot in Black culture. He's not Tom Brady, right? His longtime girlfriend before Taylor Swift was a Black woman. Right. And I think that's just a little bit too cold. I don't know if you know that. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. No.
And so I think, so that's been my theory about one reason. Like maybe they're not aware of that. I think Taylor Swift is just flirting too close culturally outside of what they think white women should be and how they should behave, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah. I mean, throughout history, it has always been the case that reactionaries, especially religious fundamentalists, one of their top priorities is controlling the bodies of women, and whether it's controlling them, what they can do with their reproduction, but also just what they're allowed to do in public, that they basically should be kept, that they are communal property. That's what women are. They are not human. They have no human rights. They are there to serve men. And by this collection of women just out there having a, and maybe they didn't know that this was from a Mardi Gras clip. Perhaps they didn't know that. And that's what this, I mean, you go to, anyone goes to New Orleans in February or the entire state of Louisiana, that's, you're going to see this scene hundreds of times, right? Because that's just what it is. But like, let's say they didn't know that, shorn of the context. Yeah, it was a violation of the social contract that they envision for their women. And they think of them as their women, that women do not have agency. They do not have, they don't have agency over any aspect. They should not have agency over any aspect of their life. That's what this really, the freakout really was about.
Right. I agree with that. And bringing this back around to Nikki Haley. So there is no environment in conservatism where a woman could really, truly be in leadership, right? Because you can't not have agency and also lead. So I'm not really sure what she's doing.
Yeah. I mean, and it says in the Bible explicitly that a woman should not be over a man, and a woman's desire should be to her husband. And like, that's, and I always love watching that interplay between right-wing women, because like, that was seeing all of that rage against these women just for dancing in public and having a good time. And they were not being sexualized in any way in their behavior, not really at all. They were modestly clothed, if that's a thing that you're supposed to do. But whatever, like, there's not really any basis that they could have criticized them, and they weren't doing drugs. But so a lot of these right-wing Christian women, they looked at that, that this outrage of the far right Christians, especially the men, but even a lot of the women, like, they looked at that and they were appalled by it, because it was going against everything that they're trying to do, which is to keep, because like, basically, like, there's this saying that right-wing Christians have about, and that have about people who are lesbian or gay, which is they cannot reproduce, so they must recruit. You ever heard that one?
Oh, no, I haven't. I've been away for long enough. Thankfully, I haven't heard that one.
And that's not true, needless to say, because of course, there are plenty of people who are bisexual or who might identify as exclusively homosexual who might occasionally have heterosexual sex. Like, that's not true. Independently of that not being true, they themselves, the Christian right, is actually in this situation now where they actually cannot recruit, because like, and Matt, I would love to hear from people, if you know of anyone, mm-hmm. of a woman who has willingly converted to far right Christianity. I just don't see that happening, unless you were brainwashed from as a girl into having some guilt and desire that this is a right thing for you to do. Unless if you had no contact with Christianity of any kind, I don't think that any woman is going to sign up for far right Christianity. So, and then at the same time, their ideas are also, so there's claims about the world. Evolution is not true. The earth is 6,000 years old. There was a flood of Noah, and there was a burning bush. And I mean, all this stuff that is just ludicrous and more mature Christians don't believe happened. There were no ancient Jewish people in Egypt that massively came out. Like, none of that's true. And so like, mature Christians don't believe that, but because those beliefs are so absurd and so obviously absurd now, people are not signing up for this stuff. So they can't recruit, and so they must reproduce. Like, right. The irony of this situation. And so, and I think that ultimately is kind of the main reason why they are so obsessed with controlling women, because if they can control women's ability to have children and do it at their command, then they still have at least some semblance of a chance of the future, because they sure as hell aren't getting converts in the United States.
Right. Which I guess brings us around to what happened, I guess, was it earlier this week or was it last week? The IVF decision out of Alabama, which, sorry, I just shifted the conversation on you.
No, it's all right. Yeah, well, and that's another example of that. And I think Tommy Tuberville, when he was asked about it, he was like, well, we need more babies. And it's like, Who says that? Nobody says that. Like, we right. have plenty of people in this country, and there's plenty of people coming in. Like, if it's not your business, however many babies there are. And if you really believe that, you would give incentives for, you would approve mandated maternity leave and federally funded maternity leave and paternity leave. If you actually right. believe that, you would do right. these things. They're not, they don't have any consistency of being pro-life, quote unquote, because they love the death right. penalty. And even with the IVF stuff, like, you are seeing that the National Party is at least pretending to support IVF. Because, I mean, as a polling matter, like, there's plenty of Republican families that have done it. But this is a great example of how this is a party that has become so much more radicalized just in the past, let's say, 10 years or so, maybe since the Tea Party, that 10, 12 years, that they have to maintain this fiction for people.
Right.
I think. And especially yeah. for women. Like, I mean, is that in your own travels and work and whatnot, like, have you seen women who have this fiction about the Republican Party? What have you seen that?
I personally don't know anyone in my sphere of friends or my community. Okay.
Well, you're lucky.
Right, because I think that it's obvious, right? I think it's very obvious. Or you have people saying, I mean, you think about 5 years ago, even just, I was going to say 10 years ago, but even 5 years ago, the idea of granting an embryo in the freezer personhood would be, we would have laughed at that. We would have literally laughed at that 10 years ago. So I don't know anyone who can't see that the two parties are not the same, right? And I'm kind of thankful for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's all I have. That's the answer to your question. I don't know anyone who thinks that, thankfully, right? I mean, it's just so obvious on so many different levels, right? And so many different ways and legislation. So, yeah.
Yeah. But unfortunately, though, like, I mean, the national media, to a large degree, does operate under that fiction in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I'm not really certain why they do that. I think maybe part of our conversation, I think we were having it earlier offline, about some of the editors or people behind the scenes could be more conservative than they are liberal or progressive. I don't really understand how they aren't. I mean, I understand in that they believe that they should, you know, report on the parties equally. But that's under normal circumstances. We aren't under normal circumstances, right? We are skirting with, or we're flirting with, rather, authoritarianism, right? And having these extreme ideas and legislation take over the country. So they have an obligation to report that the two parties are not the same. And I think for the most part, and it could be biased because of the news stations that I'm watching, that the reporters that I'm watching aren't really saying that. But enough are that it's not really making it out to all the constituents. So,
yeah. All right. Well, I guess maybe let's wrap then. What do you think are kind of the big themes that we're going to see emerging in the general election, in the presidential contest?
Oh, wow. Oh, the general election. I'm curious as to where this IVF case will land in terms of voters, particularly white women. I mean, me as a Black woman, I'm always thinking. And so when I go into a general election, the thing that's foremost on my mind, I'm not thinking about what will Black people do, right? That doesn't worry about me, right? I worry about how will white women vote, right? Because they've been kind of voting for Republicans for a really long time. And because they're voting against their own interests, it kind of affects all of us. So I think we have to watch for that, because the IVF decision, the majority of people who use IVF are white women. It's that demographic that the Republicans rely on. Their affirmative action is also something that will affect them. So I think it's something to watch out. Like, where is the needle going? And I'm curious if we look deeper at that breakdown of voters for Nikki Haley, those kind of independents or those people who are voting for her over Trump, I wonder if those are, you know, white women who are hoping to not bring on another Trump term, but can't bring themselves to vote for Democrats. So that's something to watch out for. I guess the second thing that's foremost on my mind is misinformation and disinformation, right? That's a huge one. It's kind of this invisible monster. Yeah, thinking back 3 years ago, I can't remember how long it's been since Elon Musk took over Twitter, or X, formerly known as Twitter. But we were all hand-wringing about the disinformation that's going to kind of be proliferated in that space. And we just kind of like, we stopped talking about that. And I think the assumption is that it's something that's going to happen in the future, right? It's kind of in the back of our minds that it's something that's going to happen. Well, we're in the middle of it right now, right? Every time you watch a video or you get a headline or some, you read something online, especially with all of the upheaval in relation to our foreign policy, you should assume that that information has been manipulated in some way, and you should always double check, right? So we are in the middle of the disinformation age of social media, specifically on Twitter. You're living it right now, right? And I don't really know if there are any measures to counter that. I mean, Twitter is a private company, but that's something that kind of frankly keeps me up at night. So that's probably the second thing. And I guess a close third would be foreign interference in our election, but that's related to the disinformation. We still really haven't gotten to the bottom of that, what happened in 2016. Actually, I think we have gotten to the bottom of it, but the media doesn't really cover that. I had a guest on a couple of weeks ago on the Electorate, Jackie Singh, you know, she's a cybersecurity expert, and we were talking about that and how whenever you talk about disinformation or whenever you talk about foreign interference in an election, in an election cycle, there's kind of this collective eye roll, I think, among people, especially people on social media or people who think that they're really tied into social media.
The Russia collusion hoax.
Right, exactly. And it's just like, well, these are conspiracies. There have been legitimate organizations who've uncovered that these things have happened. And I think that, frankly, the collective eye roll, that reaction has been part of the manipulation that we've all been under, right? We've somehow been taught to dismiss it and to downplay it, right? Which doesn't really make sense to me. Yeah, so those are the three things. And there's a fourth thing. I guess I'll lump those last two things together as number two. but the third thing, I think, is there are judges planted around the country, conservative judges, who are willing to... They had a playbook from 2020. They know what to do and what not to do to help Donald Trump take over an election that he hasn't actually won. And I'm a little nervous about how that will play out.
Biden and state legislatures as well.
And state legislatures, exactly. So I'm very worried about how that will play out. There are people who are sitting and willing and waiting to help Donald Trump.
Steal an election.
Yeah, exactly. I try to avoid saying that word because they also accuse us of stealing an election. But I mean, it's like they're the ones who stole the election. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, no, I think those are definitely all things to keep an eye out. And I think that it's been a great discussion. And I look forward to having everybody see a lot more of you in the future, Flux, and on this show and some of the other ones that we're doing. So I'm really excited.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Matthew. It's really fun. I love talking to you.
And so for people who want to keep tabs on what you're doing on social media, what's the best way for them?
Well, I'm mostly on Twitter, fortunately or unfortunately, at J. Taylor Skinner, right? Or Twitter, formerly known as Twitter. I'm on X as J. Taylor Skinner, right? I don't really do Facebook that often, but yeah, find me on Twitter ranting or joking about something. Two N's, that's right. J, yeah.
Okay, awesome. All right, so that is the program for today. I appreciate everybody joining us for the conversation. You can always get more if you go to theoryofchange.show. You can get the video, audio, and transcript of all the episodes. And if you are a paid subscribing member, you have unlimited access. Thank you very much for your support. That makes it possible. And if you can't afford to support at this time financially, you can actually really help out the show by subscribing on whatever platform you are using to listen to podcasts. And if you can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, that's actually really helpful as well. It helps people see the show. A written review can be even just as short as one sentence saying it's great, 5 stars. That's much appreciated. And if you're watching on YouTube, you can just click the like and subscribe button. Please do that. I really appreciate that. So that'll do it for this episode. I'll see everybody next time.